The Liberty was the pride of the fleet. She was certainly the queen of the rum runners. Our boat was the finest and fastest rum runner ever to work on this coast, and I was the only Canadian to be on her crew, right up until the time she was captured off Prince Edward Island on November 6th, which is another story I will now relate to you, and told by the first time by myself or anyone.
Wrote Hugh Corkum years later in his autobiography called On Both Sides of the Law. Before describing the bloody gunfight that ended the career of his ship called the Liberty. This is the third and final part of the Liberty on the Rocks trilogy, telling the story of the fastest rum-running ship of them all, which was powered by three airplane engines, which smuggled alcohol in the days of Prohibition. The first episode, called Shootout in Bucktouche, detailed a narrow escape in New Brunswick. The second episode, we went to Nova Scotia to look at how Hugh Corkum got involved with rum running years earlier as a 15-year-old boy. And today, we're going to PEI for the dramatic conclusion to the Liberty on the Rocks trilogy, captured in Charlottetown.
You're listening to Backyard History, the hidden stories that happened in your own backyard. The podcast version of the weekly history column running in newspapers across the Maritimes, with your host and author, Andrew McLean.
It was November 1937. The nights were getting longer, which gave us more darkness to work with and comparative safety. We were off the bench at Prince Edward Island, and we received orders to proceed to a drop near Alberton with 300 kegs of rum. It was a nice, easy drop, no risks involved, so we did not anticipate any problems. The wind was blowing very hard off the shore, which always made us feel more at ease. It meant the noise from our loud aeroplane engines and from our unloading procedures couldn't be carried toward the shore. We were very efficient, except Captain Ducas, who became helpless when work was involved. We finished unloading and proceeded out past the headlands. It was smooth going. Daylight was breaking. All was fine.
All was not fine, though. The Mounties were well aware of the famously speedy rum-running vessel named the Liberty, operating right under their noses, and they were determined to put an end to her career as the fastest speedboat on the Atlantic seaboard. An RCMP police report from 1937 says,
"The motorboat Liberty, which was built in the United States, registered in Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, and equipped with three Liberty engines, 450 horsepower each, was very active off the coast of Cape Breton, Prince Edward Island, and New Brunswick. As this is a very speedy boat, our patrol cruisers found it very difficult to intercept this boat when making landings of contraband."
In the early days of Prohibition, life had been easy for the rum runners. Policing was either done by overworked local police, or by customs officials who were so deeply corrupt in the Maritimes, it caused a political scandal so bad it brought down a federal government and triggered a national election in Canada. All those days were long over, though. There was a new sheriff in town now, the Mounties. They'd managed to acquire quite the famous American pop culture slogan for themselves, too. The Mounties always get their man. Now, the actual Mounties in the Maritimes were bound and determined to live up to that reputation, and they were going to end the liquor smuggling once and for all. The Mounties were sent into the Maritimes in the late 1920s to take over policing from these beleaguered local cops, and they were given high-speed aircraft, they were given machine guns, they were given fast ships, and they were given the funding to hire vast networks of informers. The RCMP had its own Air Force worth of spy planes, a Navy's worth of fast cutters and destroyers, and a single-minded focus on ending the rum running. This brought in a lot of arrests. Actually, 40% of all the court cases going on in the Maritimes at that time involved liquor. While the Mounties wanted to stop all the liquor smugglers, the ship they wanted to stop the most was the Liberty. Unbeknownst to Hugh Corkum, they had been devoting enormous amounts of resources to catching that boat. That 1937 RCMP report declared,
"While the motorboat Liberty was active off our coast, I had as many as 20 men on duty on the North Shore, and she took up our time and attention for almost 2 months.
On a cold and dark November night on the waters off of PEI, a Mountie police cutter spotted the ship they'd been searching for, the Liberty. Captain Duca, wireless operator Hugh Corkum, and the other four crew had already unloaded all their illegal alcohol on the shore. So perhaps they were a little too relaxed now that the mission was over and the dawn lights broke. When, according to that 1937 police report,
finally, on November 4th, the cruiser Alachasse, whilst on patrol off North Point PEI, sighted this motor vessel proceeding towards land at North Point.
Hugh Corkum wrote in his book that the Mounties had caught them by surprise.
To our great amazement, coming around North Point was the cutter Alachasse, approaching us at full speed. She was about 1,000 yards from us.
The master of the cruiser Alachasse hoisted the signal OL.
Flags were hoisted, ordering us to heave to.
The Liberty immediately changed her course and headed out to sea.
We immediately altered our course 90 degrees, full speed ahead. Although we were empty, we did not want them to board us. The Alachasse gave chase at full speed. They obviously thought they had a victim in their clutches.
The crew of the Alachasse opened fire on the Liberty.
They fired rifle shots, heavy artillery at us indiscriminately. They threw everything at us but the galley stove.
But this motorboat in a very short time outdistanced the Alachasse.
We knew we could outrun the cutter. We ran at full speed for a while to put more between us, and in a short time, the Alachasse was out of sight behind us. And with that interlude of excitement behind us, we slowed and proceeded to meet our mothership, the Nashwalk. Her position was 30 or 40 miles south of the Magdalen Islands. We talked over our close call and said that in the future, when leaving a drop, we would get outside the limits by the most direct route.
However, little did the crew of the Liberty know that there would never be another future drop. The Mounties hadn't given up, and were still hunting them.
The pursuit was continued by the cruiser Alachasse, but lost sight of the Liberty towards evening. The search was continued, and finally, on November 6th, the Liberty was sighted tied up alongside the motor vessel Nashwalk at a position 16 miles southeast of Entry Island, Magdalen Islands.
Next morning, we were having a quiet time alongside the Nashwalk, chatting and awaiting orders for the next move. One of the boys looked to the northwest, said there was a cutter approaching us at full speed.
Here the two stories differ slightly. The RCMP claim that as soon as they spotted them, the Liberty made a break for it. Hugh Corkum, on the other hand, claimed that they did not run immediately because they didn't think they'd been positively identified during their previous run-in. This meant that the Mounties weren't allowed to board them. Also, more critically, the Liberty was still tied up to the Nashwalk, making their escape more difficult. However, as the Mounties' cutter drew closer, it became clear that they intended to stop the Liberty at all costs.
The cutter stopped about 100 feet away, and someone said in a loud voice,
"We are coming on board."
The chief engineer of the Liberty shouted back,
"Like hell you are."
He jumped down to the engine room, and in the twinkling of an eye, the engines were going, without any instructions or orders from our captain. We did not even pull up our fenders or untie the mooring lines. It wasn't necessary. When you put those clutches into gear and revved up the engines, she would raise her bow, dig in her stern, and take off so swiftly and forcefully that if you had nothing to hold on to, it could be serious.
The Liberty immediately left the Nashwalk, and the cruiser Alachasse gave chase.
We were in the wide open before anybody could count to 10. She parted her moorings like they were cod lines. We were on our way full speed ahead, with spray flying 15 feet high off the bow. The only thing that could catch us was a bullet, which is exactly what happened. They were firing at point-blank range with live ammunition. Suddenly, I saw several splinters of wood split off by bullets ricocheting off the woodwork. And the captain let go of the wheel and flopped down on the floor, face down. I quickly turned him around. He was hit. His face was a mass of blood, and he was unconscious. I thought for sure he was a goner. And the bullets were still coming. Things were getting serious. I decided enough was enough and rang the engine room telegraphs to stop the engines, After a few minutes, the captain became conscious and asked what happened. I told him we'd stopped and a boarding party was approaching. The first thing the boarding party did was administer first aid to the captain, who was really in pain.
After firing a number of rounds, the Liberty was seized and towed towards Source PEI. At the time of the seizure, the Liberty had no cargo on board.
The captain was well looked after. He was taken to hospital, where his wound was dressed and his condition was reported to be okay.
The Liberty was towed to Charlottetown and held pending decision of the department.
Our instructions were to stay in Charlottetown until further notice. After several weeks in Charlottetown, there was still no decision from Ottawa regarding charges against us, so they decided they had no further use for us. We could go home.
It's not particularly clear why they weren't charged in this specific case, but the short version is that, for the most part, hardly anybody shared the Mountie's enthusiasm for halting the Rum Runners. The general public was actually quite supportive of the smugglers, considering them to be ordinary maritimers who were doing what they needed to feed their families in the hard times of the Great Depression. Meanwhile, judges and the legal system more generally were actually somewhat suspicious of the heavy-handed tactics the Mounties had become known for. In effect, in this case, it appears that charges were ultimately not pursued by prosecutors against the Liberty because it was not entirely clear that the actions taken that day by the Mounties would have, shall we say, stood up in court. The Mounties, though, were pleased with themselves about what happened that day. Their police report on the incident concluded by declaring,
"The motorboat Liberty ceased operations. Therefore, the seizure made by the cruiser Alachasse was very satisfactory to me."
In the end, Hugh Corkum and his fellow rumrunners from the Liberty were ultimately not convicted.
We were extremely fortunate to escape court procedure and trial. Regardless of what troubles arise, a good lawyer always finds a means to solve problems. I believe rum running was not taken too seriously in those days because many good people were involved in the business, in one way or another. I think that was a factor that contributed to it being taken lightly by many people, including in the judicial system. Also, our lawyer was the best in the business. He said he would clear us all if the pay was good enough. I guess it was.
While the Liberty herself remained impounded in PEI, the crew was all released, and everyone went their separate ways. Seemingly unperturbed by his arrest and his near death at the hands of the law, Hugh Corkum returned to rum running. However, he found that without his cherished ship, the Liberty, and the crew he knew so well, it was really different. On the new ship he joined, they suffered a series of increasingly dire events. There were the multiple gunfights with the Mounties. There was a severe gas leak, and there was a fire on board a ship, which, out of all the incidents, that was the one that gave him greatest pause, and he wrote,
"Fire is about the most dreaded possibility on a ship, where there's little room to run. One most certainly have to wonder why in heaven's name a man with all his marbles would ever let himself get into such a predicament. Skyride on a keg of rum, it's not the best way to enter heaven."
Through all the accidents, Hugh Corkum wrote that there was one other, vastly more persuasive reason that it might be time to move out of this life as a criminal alcohol smuggler.
"The time had come when a respectable job ashore was a high priority. I had a lovely wife, fishing skipper's daughter, whom I learned to love very much. She was the direct opposite of me, church-going girl, and she detested my rum running. My wife was an important motivating force. It really is amazing how the inspiration and beliefs of those around you can mold everything towards good."
Another motivating factor to get out of the rum running business was that Hugh Corkum had also had, in 1937, a daughter named Sandra Veenstra. Sandra is today 86 years young, and she helped out with the research for the story about her father. As a child, Hugh Corkum had always been fascinated with the police. This was because his father's best friend, when he was growing up, was Lunenburg's chief of police. when he was a little boy, he would try and hang out with the police officers. He would try and listen in on their conversations. He'd always wanted to grow up, ironically enough, considering his career path, he'd always wanted to grow up to be a police officer. Despite his life taking him in a different direction, in fact, the exact opposite direction of police work, seeing how he actually grew up to be a renowned criminal, Hugh Corkum had actually always been legged by the by-then-aging chief of police of Lunenburg. Despite being a well-known rum runner, Hugh would stop by and visit the old chief of police whenever he went home to visit his family and wife in Lunenburg.
He was a good man, respected by all citizens. Whenever I was home in Lunenburg, I made it a point to have a yarn with him, especially on Sunday afternoons when things were quiet around town.
Yearning to get out of the liquor smuggling game, Hugh Corkum decided to ask this old chief of police about getting a job as a cop.
I told the chief of police a job ashore was a priority for me. I had heard a new policeman would soon be needed. He told me to put in an application if I was sure I would like police work. He warned me it was a hell of a job to be a policeman in your own hometown, but if I really wanted to give it a try, he would do all he could to help me when a position became available.
Obviously, the chief of police knew Hugh Corkum had been involved in illegal smuggling. However, he doesn't seem to have held it against him. Much like how the judges in Charlottetown had been at least vaguely sympathetic towards the crew of the Liberty and they let them go, many other Maritimers also didn't really hold their activities against them. For example, according to a 1938 government report by M.H. Vernon,
"Maritimers all down the scale of position, education, and social order who look upon the smuggling of rum as a right, a sort of glorified sport, and as a seal of good fellowship."
Which seems to explain the warm reception that Hugh Corkum received when he personally delivered his application to become a police officer to Lunenburg's elites, some of who he actually probably delivered alcohol to in the past.
"My application was delivered to the town office, and I made a personal visit to the mayor and councilors. I pushed pretty hard, told them my ambition to become the next chief of police of Lunenburg. Several of the councilors I visited expressed satisfaction with my candid approach. After several weeks, I received an official letter from the town office dated February 11th, 1939, notifying me that the job of night watchman was mine at a salary of $65 a month."
Hugh Corkum would go on to become the chief of police of Lunenburg for several decades.
Hugh Corkum, voiced by Jordan Batstone.
That was Backyard History with your host, Andrew McLean. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for another hidden story that happened in your own backyard. Produced by Jordan Lozier.